Let me talk to you a little bit about teaching antitrust and teaching Microsoft in the age of Microsoft. Last spring, I had the time of my academic life. I led an antitrust seminar on Microsoft. The seminar materials were downloaded daily from the antitrust division, from Microsoft, from the New York Times, and from the Wall Street Journal, all of whom had video and audio and websites that were readily available. Videos of contemporaneous Senate hearings were interspersed in the seminar. The only real lack, as a matter of timing, was the video of the super video legal star, super litigator David Boies, who made his famous opening statement, complete with sound bites from Bill Gates' deposition, juxtaposed with blow-ups on the video screen of contemporaneous Microsoft emails, which at least he claimed, and I'm sure Rick contradicts, denied Mr. Gates' denials, established Mr. Gates' lack of authenticity in Mr. Gates' denials of recollection of knowledge or of asserting certain things which appeared the Microsoft email seemed to establish that he had. My point is that 5 years ago, 4 years ago, it would have been impossible to undertake such a seminar for the simple reason that without the web, without daily updated antitrust division and Microsoft websites, the material would simply not have been available for contemporaneous examination. The seminar began with a close analysis of the complaint and the consent decree in the first Microsoft case. Midway through the semester, contemporaneous developments overtook seminar plans. We watched Orrin Hatch's Senate hearings, which served as a turning point from the consent decree to a potential new case. With rumors of a new antitrust case to be brought by the Justice Department flying high, the seminar turned to the preparation of a series of papers and oral presentations addressed to either possible theories of antitrust liability in a case yet to be brought, or potential remedies in a case yet to be brought. When the seminar began, Judge Jackson had just issued a preliminary injunction, which ordered Microsoft to cease and desist from conditioning the licensing of its operating system on the licensing of a browser. Judge Jackson's decision, it will be recalled, arose from a contempt proceeding initiated by the department, which claimed that Microsoft was in clear violation of an unambiguous provision of the consent decree in Microsoft. The notion that that decree was unambiguous, it seemed to me, was an exercise in chutzpah, technical term. The government prayed for $1 million a day in damages for the clear violation. Judge Jackson rejected the contempt request but issued a preliminary injunction. And then you will recall that Judge Jackson proceeded to appoint Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard, a superb and uniquely qualified cyber law expert, as a special master to take evidence and to recommend findings of fact, conclusions of law. A controversy ensued over the appointment of Professor Lessig. Microsoft petitioned for his removal, denied by Judge Jackson. Microsoft appealed the Lessig appointment and the decree below on the violation of the consent decree, and the D.C. Circuit, a month after the case was filed, ruled in favor of Microsoft on both issues. Meanwhile, the seminar proceeded on two tracks. One examined the documents and the contempt proceedings and used it as a vehicle for studying and learning about the law of tying and monopolization. Initially, the students delivered mini presentations on monopolization. The second track examined reports in the media about the ongoing Microsoft litigation. As events unfolded and the prospect of a new Microsoft case loomed larger, track two dominated the seminar. We then proceeded to a rigorous examination of the possible alternatives available in a suit against Microsoft. a new lawsuit by the government against Microsoft. What began as a study of litigation and contempt proceeding turned after the hearings into a study of what new attacks, what new remedies can be achieved. I asked the students to prepare papers and presentations responsive to the issue of potential theories of antitrust liability against Microsoft and what remedy alternatives would be available. This is prior to the government initiating and the AG's instituting the current suit. Interestingly, of the students that wrote on liability, the majority took the position that no new antitrust action should be brought by the Justice Department. One particularly lively paper, which I can get to you if you want, was Why Microsoft Should Be Left Alone. Another creative free marketeer drafted an amicus brief in support of Microsoft's position. Most of the papers which weighed in for Microsoft argued that not to allow Microsoft to integrate its browser with its operating system would stifle innovation and development in the software industry. Only one student who wrote on liability didn't defend Microsoft but advocated an alternative theory of monopoly leveraging but reserved judgment on whether that theory would ultimately prevail. The students who wrestled with the remedies problem were faced with far more difficult and challenging problems. What do we do with Microsoft? Breaking up Microsoft was the solution one student offered in a paper entitled Browsers and Baby Bills. good titles. One student recognized the differences between Microsoft and traditional manufacturing companies and advocated that the government compel Microsoft to grant open licenses on Windows as an alternative to breaking up the company. Poetically, as the seminar wound down, the Department of Justice and the states wound up and filed their lawsuit. Subsequent merger of Netscape and AOL prompted South Carolina to leave the lawsuit, raised many of the concerns that a number of my seminar students felt that in defending Microsoft's position. And recent reports of Microsoft's internal reorganization into four component parts is reminiscent of some of the remedies suggested by the students. Some decades ago, I hesitate to tell you how many, I and my spiritual fellow panelist, Harry First, who couldn't be here, were fortunate enough to learn antitrust from an extraordinary teacher. Is this mic okay? Are you okay? And scholar at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Louis B. Schwartz. Subsequently, I participated in a seminar with Lou Schwartz devoted exclusively to the question of divestiture. My assignment was to draft a non-punitive but effective divestiture plan for General Motors. That was at a time when one out of every three cars in America sold was a Chevy. Assuming that GM would be an unlawful monopolist, I chose to spin off Chevrolet and the engine and transmission operations. I learned, as Lou Schwartz of course intended, that examining antitrust through the prism of divestiture and alternative remedies, it can be an exciting way to explore first principles of antitrust goals and policies, and it's rarely done. Depending on the timing of the real-world Microsoft litigation events concerning settlement, relief, appeals, I can imagine a fall 1999-2000 antitrust seminar, which I'll be teaching, exploring antitrust law and policy in the computer era in the year 2000 by looking at how relief could be fashioned in the United States versus Microsoft. One could, and I think should, at the outset, consider some of the relief imposed by the Federal Trade Commission in other high technology industries, and then explore the relative merits of a burgeoning list of proposed Microsoft relief possibilities. Consider three complicated technical cases settled by the FTC in the computer area. In the Digital Intel case, Digital entered into a consent decree under which it granted perpetual and generally non-terminable licenses of its Alpha architecture to Samsung and AMD and other suitable partners approved by the commission. This was an architectural license under which the licensee would be free to create its own implementation and derivative works. That is, to design original chips around the architecture with a caveat that the licensee maintain backward compatibility with the Alpha architecture. In a second case, Silicon Graphics. The consent order required Silicon Graphics to enter into a porting agreement with a commission-approved partner that would allow the partner to run the two most important programs. The porting agreement was designed to ensure that at least one other workstation manufacturer would have access to the important graphics packages in litigation. In a third case, Cadence Design. The consent order required Cadence to allow developers of commercially integrated routing tools to participate in a Cadence Connections program and any other Cadence independent software programs that enables independent software developers to sell interfaces to Cadence layout tools. The key aspect of relief in the last two cases was the use of a non-discrimination provision aimed at preventing self-favoritism. Turning from consent decrees already imposed, what I'd like to just present to you, without advocating one or the other, is a list of possible remedies to be imposed in Microsoft. And if Microsoft's not settled by the next fall, that's how I'm going to start my next Microsoft seminar. Consider structural remedies. Horizontal divestiture. Set up separate operating systems, application systems, and content provider systems. Vertical divestiture. Reorganize Microsoft into multiply vertically integrated entities, known colloquially as baby bills. Question is, who gets Papa Bill? Conduct remedies. Require Microsoft to provide Windows licensees with technical information regarding specification and revision of the operating system at the same time that such information is provided to Microsoft's application developers. Second, require Microsoft to publish, you don't do all of these. These are possibilities. Require Microsoft to publish sufficient technical information to enable a complementary product to run on Microsoft's operating systems. Third, prohibit Microsoft from intentionally disabling or otherwise interfering with the intended functionality and execution of other products which are interoperable with Microsoft's operating system. I'm sure Rick would say there's no need for that because Microsoft doesn't do that. Prohibit Microsoft from suggesting that other products may be incompatible unless they are in fact known to be incompatible. Prohibit Microsoft from tying any other product to Microsoft's operating system. Prohibit Microsoft as a dominant firm from giving away free products for more than 3 months during a promotional period. Prohibit Microsoft from entering into anti-competitive arrangements which either require licensees to train engineers on other Microsoft products as a condition for getting a Windows license, or which restrict licensees from testing or benchmarking Microsoft products, or which require cross-licensing of patents, or which require licensees to provide Microsoft unrelated technical and marketing information. I'm winding down if you want me out. 5 minutes?
I'll do it in three, okay? 2.5.
Prohibit Microsoft from limiting the ability of hardware manufacturers or end users to reconfigure desktops to utilize other software. Prohibit Microsoft from dissuading content providers from using competing browsers. Prohibit Microsoft from pre-announcing products more than 6 months prior to their actual installation. Prohibit Microsoft from enforcing intellectual property rights to prevent reverse engineering of Microsoft operating system products. Require non-discriminatory and timely access to Windows application program interfaces. Require compulsory licensing of application program interfaces. Require compulsory licensing of Windows source codes. Require an auction of Windows source code licenses. Require federal standardization of Windows by the American National Standards Institute. Prohibit predatory pricing. Prohibit the bundling of operating systems and application content. Prohibit the imposition of restrictions on original equipment manufacturers on boot up sequences and applications. Well, obviously, it would not take minutes and not hours, but days and weeks to try and realistically explore these alternatives. I think it's an essential undertaking. I don't think that you can think rationally about using antitrust against Microsoft without thinking through ahead of time, not after the fact, whether any, all, or some of these things are good for the industry and the country. Of course, by the fall of 1999, many of these issues could become moot if Microsoft and the Justice Department agree to a consent decree, and if Judge Jackson approves the decrees in the public interest, unlike his Stanley Sporker. But moot or not, the issues of appropriate relief in Microsoft will continue to provide fertile ground for future seminars, for law reviews, and, I suggest, will remain a useful fulcrum for imagining how the legal landscape, or is it spacescape, of cyberspace should look in an ideal but increasingly complicated high technology computer antitrust universe. Thank you.
Panelists want to ask each other questions. Certainly the audience is invited to ask questions of the panelists, but if you do so, we would ask that you approach the microphone slowly to avoid any injury issues, and speak clearly into the microphone. Anybody want to start off? Bob Levy, Kate Owens.
A couple of panels mentioned predatory pricing, so let me raise this as a possibility. As many of you know, Microsoft gives away its browser, and when it does so, the government cries foul. So when Microsoft isn't being accused of monopoly price gouging for charging too much, it's being accused of predatory pricing for charging too little. The real money in browsers doesn't come from the sale of browsers. It comes from advertising and electronic commerce. So it's like network TV, which, of course, is free, and it's like controlled circulation magazines, which are, of course, free, but you are obliged, if you get these free services, to look at the advertising. In that sense, the browser can profitably be given away because it generates ancillary revenue, and this is a condition that economists characterize as having a negative marginal cost, and that's why neither Microsoft nor Netscape, who, of course, was the first to price its browser at zero, neither of those firms is engaged in predatory pricing. The browser's zero price is more than its negative marginal cost. That alone negates a predatory pricing claim, the first element of which is that the price has to fall below marginal cost. My question is, what do you think of that?
Any comments from any of the other panelists?
Person, oh, all right, I'll vote for. I'll say a few things on the subject. I mean, Rick raised questions about what is predatory pricing, and the reality is that this is one of the key issues that differentiates Chicago school approach to antitrust from the post-Chicago reconstruction that's going on and beginning to gain increased adherence. The in the era in which the Chicago school really dominated antitrust, it almost eliminated predatory pricing from the antitrust vocabulary, coming up with an extremely narrow approach, which has been endorsed by the Supreme Court. One question that a lot of people are trying to deal with is, does predatory pricing exist often enough to be of concern and to be something the government should go after? Let me backtrack for a few minutes before I get to dealing with the question Bob raised. Look at airlines. Right now, the Department of Transportation is attempting to deal with what it sees as predatory pricing at fortress hubs. They're having a hard time dealing with it because the current prevailing law on the subject almost defines predation out of existence, makes it very hard to prove in an antitrust context. And yet when they look, the Department of Transportation, a lot of other people look at what's happened at hub terminals, they find that when new entrants attempt to create new airlines or new routes at a dominated hub, that the dominant air carrier comes in, cuts its prices very, very low, puts on additional seating, and continues this until the new entrant gives up and exits the market. This has happened time and again, and finally, the Department of Transportation is trying to deal with it, but they're faced with a problem of, hey, I see it out there and it's happening and it's real, but the economists and those who've taken their cue from the Chicago School of Economists on this, and Rick and I are both graduates of the University of Chicago Law School, we just disagree about some of this. The economists say this, it happens so rarely that and it's too dangerous to go after it because we will freeze aggressive competition. We shouldn't go after people who price their products too low because what we want is low pricing. The problem is, if you look at the air hubs, as soon as the new entrant exits the market, the dominant firm raises its prices very high. Now, there are a lot of issues here. One issue is, what do we mean by recoupment? When we say that you only engage in predatory pricing if you can recoup your investment, the lost money, through higher prices, that's a very narrow interpretation. It's narrow because the rationale for predatory pricing may be different. It may be we're going to establish ourselves as a company that everybody else knows is a real aggressive competitor, and that we will punish anyone that comes in against us. We won't necessarily recoup our investment in this particular market where we cut the price. We may recoup it in other ways through the strategic advantage that we gain against our competitors. There's also a problem in this field of what does it mean to price below cost. Now, there's been a lot of difficulty defining exactly what we mean when costs are relatively stagnant, but when you enter into a network type of industry where the marginal cost falls way down low, whether it's software where the marginal incremental unit of software costs almost nothing, or in airlines where the marginal cost for one more seat may be next to nothing. And then we set up a test where predation can only occur if the price is set below the marginal price, the marginal cost. We've set up a situation where you will never be able to prove predation. And then if you do, as Rick suggests, eliminate subjectivity so that intent becomes irrelevant, now you've got it fixed so that you're never going to be able to find the moons of Jupiter. They don't exist because theologically they can't exist. But it's happening out there, and competitors know that it's happening, and strategic planners know that it's happening. Take it back finally to the issue that Bob raised in the Microsoft context, where there may be advertising revenues that come along with a browser. Well, maybe. My understanding is that if you look at the average cost of creating the software, you're not recovering average cost out of the advertising. I don't know what the answer is empirically, whether that's true or not true. This is what I'm told, that the average costs are not recovered as a result of the advertising. What I would say, though, is if you're giving away the product and you're able to do that in large part because you're tying it to a monopoly, and the other guys out there have to make a profit on the product, then you've got an advantage that will allow you to maintain a monopoly and drive out the competition. And that's what it appears to me is the case here.
Bob, just make Rick a couple points. First of all, I think it's important to bring us all back to something that predates even the Chicago School, but is pretty much holy writ in the antitrust realm, and that is the notion that the laws protect competition and not competitors. And I think if you lose sight of that, you pretty much lose sight of the whole purpose of the law. Now, airlines, I won't address. I actually happen to represent one, but I don't get paid to talk about them publicly. But I will refer you to a study that Professors Ordover and Willig did, looking at the DOT rules, and basically pointing out the perverse results of rules like that, how essentially there are a lot of causes, for example, for some of the problems of the discount airlines, not the least of which was the crash of the value jet plane in the Everglades, that the result of this search for the moons of Jupiter. We don't really know them, but you know, maybe they're around Mars. So let's blot out all the moons on Mars. The result is that consumers pay higher prices. Let me turn to the Microsoft case. I mean, the real absurdity of the predatory pricing claim is the notion that part of it goes back to the question of integration and whether or not you're going to force a company that essentially makes a product that has multiple functionality inherently built into it, which is what the Court of Appeals recognized, that essentially a company can't provide that product as a whole with those multiple functions exposed to consumers, but instead has to charge for each function. The Court of Appeals, at least, thought that was a pretty absurd result, and it was reflected in their opinion. You also have the fact that what the government is focused on is the revenues from browsers. And they say that the harm to competition is the elimination of the revenue from browsers. First of all, if you look at Netscape's initial philosophy and even some of the documents at the time they came up with their first browser, they never really expected to generate a lot of revenue off of browsers. Their clients in the client-server nomenclature. They really expected to generate most of their money off of servers. It turned out because they had a browser that was out there and they really were so much better initially than everybody else, they found out they could actually charge some people for it and they made some money off of it, which is interesting behavior, but you might say that, gee, that they maybe thought they were monopolists. But then in a sort of verification of the strength of these markets, Microsoft came along and essentially, I would say, returned the price of browsers to the competitive level, which was to give them away. Now, was that terrible? I mean, was that predation? Well, let's think. Now, predation only makes sense if I can drive my competitor out of the market and eliminate whatever assets he had so they can't come back into the market immediately upon my raising price. Well, did Microsoft accomplish that? Well, no, not by any stretch of the imagination. All that happened was Netscape was forced to compete. They had to look for other sources of revenue, like charging advertising on the portal site, like selling server revenues. They, in effect, found Microsoft catching up with them, but they haven't gone out of business. Indeed, they're neck and neck with Microsoft. And then guess what happens about 3 months ago? They sell their company for about 8 times its capital market value. $10 billion is what their shareholders got. Now, we should all be so lucky to be predated against like that. The fact is that it's competition, and that's what, if you lose sight in the antitrust laws of competition, and that's what you're protecting in the interests of consumers, you end up with a lot of lawyers and economists sitting around talking about, well, how do we protect the Netscapes of the world? How do we ensure that what's going on today doesn't go on tomorrow, ignoring what's going on around the marketplace that's going to change things anyway, beyond what you can imagine? And that ultimately is the problem with DOJ's case, because maybe it sounds good in theory, but when you actually look at the facts, you actually look at the way the market is operating, it's very hard to see how consumers and competition are being harmed. And frankly, I think that's what a lot of people, you know, that we've talked about the man in the street. That's why if you tend to, I mean, if you believe that there is wisdom in the common man, and you believe that that ever gets revealed in polls, then I think those who may think that it's great that common man is now paying attention to antitrust, and I tend to agree with that, will be surprised to learn that the common man thinks the government's case generally is all wet, and that remedies like breaking up Microsoft are absurd by very large majorities.
Professor Zittrain?
I love Rick's invocation of polls as the way to figure out this problem, sort of antitrust by Ricky Lake. But that aside... That aside, I just want to trace where the argument is
right
now.
She could not be here today, by the way.
That's too bad. Perhaps more people would have voted to see her than us. But that aside, here's where I think the argument is right now. It's the typical, so far, Chicago school versus post-Chicago school argument about if you have predatory pricing, is that a problem that we should be chasing as a government or as an instrument in the antitrust system? And the point that has been raised is, well, wait a minute. If somebody exercises in predatory pricing, they give away their product for less than it really costs them to produce it. That may well drive other competitors out of the market, but then they have to recoup. They're going to have to raise their price later to somehow make benefit off of it. And to say, well, somehow they'll make money in other divisions, well, that may well be true, but what's the benefit of having won your battle in this area if it's a money loser for you? I mean, it does make sense to look at it area by area. So the argument from the Chicago School, as we hear it, is it doesn't make much sense to act this way if you're a rational market actor, because after a while you're going to have to raise your prices to recoup, and as soon as you raise your prices, everybody comes streaming back into the market and clobbers you. So isn't there really no problem? And the airline example was what we used to see. And now we had some response to that with the idea, well, it's hard to kind of enter and exit really quickly with an airline. You don't just buy a few 737s the minute that Delta raises their prices after they've successfully driven out the last competitor. But that's sort of on the margins, too. You'd figure eventually that could smooth itself out. But what I want to propose is that this isn't the whole story. We're working in a networked environment. One of the questions Bob asked to start us off was, is there anything different about software and about cyberspace that actually adds to this ages-old debate about, say, predation and recoupment? And I want to suggest there is. The way I suggest there is because motion in this environment is Newtonian. It's not Aristotelian. And by that I mean, unlike the traditional model that says the minute you stop competing, the minute you stop innovating and pricing in a way that actually reflects your true costs, the minute you stop doing that, everybody else comes in and competes with you. Your arrow stops moving the minute you stop pushing it. So you can't lay back on pushing it for a while in order to push it harder later. But in a networked environment, that's not so. If you can actually establish an early dominance in a field, there are reasons to think in the networked environment that you can retain that dominance, even if you don't have the best possible product revealed either through market preference or through some objective analysis of whether IE is better than Netscape. And I want to say up front at the moment, IE is better than Netscape as far as I'm concerned. But that's not relevant. The point is that if you can establish early dominance in the market, look at it with OSes. If you get the predominant OS out there and everybody starts running it, people start writing applications for it, and then you keep running the OS and the applications keep growing. Now, if somebody wants to come up with a competitive OS that is, let us suppose, somehow we know it's better, double-blind taste tests show people prefer this new OS, there's a problem.
An operating system for the uninitiated.
Yes.
It took me a while. Yes.
I'm sorry, this operating system. The problem is that the operating system doesn't do a whole lot for you without all of these applications that run on it. A great example may be Linux today. You may not have heard of Linux. There's a good reason for it. If you try to install and run Linux on your home computer, not only is it difficult, once you do it, now what? You don't have Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, Internet Explorer, all jumping up really easily to be used. This means that if you could establish early on your dominance, say, in operating systems, that gives you a whole lot of momentum, Newtonian inertia, that you can bank on later and is possibly the basis for the recoupment that has been challenged by the Chicago School. Now, the only other question to ask is, well, isn't everybody on an equal footing as far as getting in early so they can be the first and then the lasting competitor in the market? And sure enough, you know, it might have been through luck or skill or something else that Microsoft originally got its dominance in the home operating system computer market. Why begrudge them that? Somebody had to win, if you're listening to my argument, and that makes sense. The only question then is, in these new markets, markets for browsers, for example, can we have the battle there be quote-unquote fair? Maybe there will end up being a dominant browser because of the forces I'm describing. But if there is, do we want to have it be a level playing field where everybody gets a crack at it, or is there some way in which Microsoft, having already won the war in the operating system area, at least for the moment, can be leveraging that power, that monopoly power, such as it is, in order to be the one who wins in the new territory, say, of the browser? And if the answer to that question is yes, now you have found a basis that actually doesn't contradict the Chicago School thesis to say we need to intervene in some way. Otherwise, the person who takes all in that limited lottery of operating system can cascade into taking all in each and every successor environment.
Do we need to define for anybody either network effects or network externalities just to make clear what the assumption is that you...
Can I comment on it? And I'll define it as well.
Sure. Bob Levy.
The theory of network effects is basically that high-tech consumers in the Microsoft area are concerned about compatibility of their software applications, so they might be seduced into purchasing inferior goods. It refers, when you talk about network effects or network externalities, to the change in the perceived value of a product that's brought about by an increase in the number of users of that product. As more people use the product, the more the value rises. The perfect example, I think, is the telephone. If there's only one user of a telephone, the instrument is worthless. You have no one to talk to. But as the installed base gets bigger and bigger, there are returns to scale. The instrument becomes more and more valuable as you get a bigger and bigger installed base. And so the theory is that the first mover in these markets has an enormous advantage. And that's the proposition that Jonathan put forward. However, we have first movers like WordPerfect, which was not the anointed king of word processing for very long, and Lotus, which was not the ruler in perpetuity of spreadsheets for very long, and Novell with its server software, which didn't last for very long. And if you have kids like I do, now 15-year-old, but a couple years ago he was very actively using Nintendo, which of course had software cartridges, and when competitors came along, none of their software cartridges were compatible, so one would think that Nintendo would have a lock on the marketplace, but indeed Nintendo lost out to Sega. Sega in turn lost out to Sony. Sony in turn, as I understand it from kids now, is losing out to Nintendo once again. So as we see, consumers, when they decide that there's a better product out there, they are not locked into inferior goods. They in fact find it within their means to go out and purchase the new products that they prefer.
Any other panelists want to weigh in on this?
I'd just like
Professor Page. I'm sorry. We need to change tape. Professor Page.
I think all sides concede that the network externalities or network effects story has relevance in the Microsoft case, but it usually turns out that it doesn't have that many implications for the outcome in the case. And part of the difficulty, one of the reasons Jonathan adverted to, is that if you view network effects as predicting this kind of original sin that, you know, you're doomed to one particular outcome, what difference does it make who wins? But there are potentially other difficulties with it. First of all, the network externalities argument has greatest relevance with respect to the operating system itself. It's less clear that there are strong network effects with respect to browsers. It is entirely possible that because of the nature of the browser market, that you can have clearly have survival of a number of competing browsers at the same time. It's less clear that will follow in the case of the operating system. Furthermore, you know, it's also been adverted to that the fact that there are network effects doesn't mean that that standards don't change, and we've seen this in numerous examples where beta had the initial lead in VCRs and was ultimately overtaken by VHS, it's never the case, even in the context, even if you look at the theoretical literature of network effects, that it predicts that a particular standard will win and then will become locked in permanently. In fact, there are some stories that in which the market will inefficiently jump to a new standard because people are afraid of being stranded with an old and outdated standard, and sometimes new entrants can benefit from that in moving to the new standard. So I'm not sure that the theory of network effects tells us very much from a policy point of view on an antitrust issue in this case.
Professor Zittrain?
Now, this is a very good question. I'm might say, why browsers? Why should we, even if we credit that there are network effects that take place in operating systems because of the relationship, for example, that I described between the operating system and the applications that kind of keep you locked in, you might say, why browsers? And that's a similar question to say, why solitaire? You know now that bundled with most versions of Windows comes a game called Solitaire that you play, and it's solitaire. And sure enough, if there were budding solitaire manufacturers out there, they may be bemoaning their fate because it's very hard to sell people a solitaire program when there already is one. But again, so what? You know, that might be what Microsoft chooses to give away, and the price of the operating system must reflect whatever it costs them to write or to obtain some version of solitaire. But I do want to suggest that there is something different about browsers than just any old other piece of software. In a way, Microsoft's argument that the browser is integral to the operating system actually hints at this. There was a period of time when Netscape, as a browser, included functionality in it. It still does, but it's no longer really being developed, called Java. And what was Java all about? Java was an idea that said if you write it once, that is directing to software developers, if you bother to write your program once, if you write it for Java, we'll try to see to it that it'll run on any computer or any operating system. This is the write once, run anywhere idea. Now, this would be very interesting because if it took place that pretty much everything from a TRS-80 to a Pentium chip computer to a Macintosh to a Sun Spark station, each of them said, Java, I know about that. I'm your operating system, but I can do Java too. And most of the software turned out to be in Java. Then you could switch between operating systems. You like one with a lot of graphics, or maybe you like one without a lot of graphics, and you wouldn't have to make the sacrifice of the software, so long as the software was written in Java. And you could even see launching into the new standard of Java by making sure that Java worked on a Windows machine, the prevailing operating system in the consumer market. If it did, people with Windows machines wouldn't even have to leave immediately. They could just run Java, and when they got a program that was written for Java and not for Windows, they would still be able to run it even though they had Windows. They also have Java on top of it. So why am I babbling about all of this? Well, the reason I'm babbling about all of this is because Netscape implemented Java in a way that was hewing to this common standard. Internet Explorer comes along and says, we're going to implement Java as well. This is the way that if you have IE, you can run Java software, but we will change it a little bit. Now, that's a perfectly rational thing. If the company wants to do it, they can change it. They implement it how they want, although there's another lawsuit on this subject still going on. But now here's the strategic reason why you'd want to change it a little bit. If you change it a little bit, then somebody who is writing their software for Java has to make a decision. Am I writing it for the Java that runs on the TRS-80, the Pentium chip, the everything else, the Netscape, blah, 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 or am I writing it for the Java that is changed for IE, for Internet Explorer? And if I write it for IE, I then have to write two copies. It's not write once, run anywhere anymore. And if I write it for the IE, maybe I won't bother to write it for all the other platforms. Now you can understand why the battle to see whether Internet Explorer will be the predominant browser or Netscape takes on a new dimension. If Internet Explorer beats out Netscape, its version of Java beats out Netscape's version, which means you no longer have the Java that is write once, run anywhere. And if Internet Explorer loses, then there is the chink in the armor that is exactly the kind of story that says, here's how beta can lose to VHS in the long run, to say, here is the way in to have the next operating system be different from the earlier one. That's, to me, why the browser isn't just like Solitaire, and why, again, you can see that not only giving away Internet Explorer, but entering into the kinds of agreements that were alleged in the case and that have yet to be ruled upon, that say you're using your monopoly power to unduly be able to promote Internet Explorer and get it to become the new standard, is actually a form of monopoly maintenance of the operating system, not just a form of establishing dominance in a new little area akin to Solitaire.
Bert Fohr had a comment he wanted to make, and I know that Rick Rule appears to be interested in a possible response. I don't know how I know that.
Just two quickies. Number one, Rick is right. There's a mantra in antitrust that it's competition we protect, not competitors. I don't know if that means anything, but I mean, we all believe it. I believe it. I believe it. But I also believe that at a certain time it becomes meaningless. If you've got one competitor, and its name is Netscape, and you eliminate it, and we go after this in an antitrust case, have we protected a competitor or are we protecting competition? So it comes a point where it doesn't mean too much. The other thing is we're telling different stories, conflicting stories. The court is going to have to decide which story is closest to the truth. The different stories lead to different kinds of remedies. So when we complain that there hasn't been enough discussion of remedies, that the government has not gone forward explaining precisely what remedy it wants to have invoked, one of the reasons for that is not just strategic, but until you narrowly define the violation and with some finality, very difficult to talk rationally about the remedy, and we're in that position right now.
Let me just make one response to what Bert just said, which I think is a very good point, and it kind of relates to one of the things that Professor Orlin talked about. One of the difficulties, for example, with the list of potential remedies that were discussed is, in some way, there's no evidence in the record concerning any of the violations that they might address. I mean, there's sometimes urban myths about some of those, but the fact is the government hasn't done anything to try to prove, for example, that Microsoft engaged in predatory pre-announcements or something of that sort. So there is some need to, I think, tie remedy discussions to the issues, though, as I think I suggested, and I certainly want to emphasize here, I believe it's a premature discussion, and it may be, at the end of the day, a discussion that's best held on campuses because it's really an academic question when Microsoft wins. But Java, Jonathan has an interesting description of Java that, frankly, is the first time I've ever heard anyone quite describe the facts the way Jonathan did. Java is actually a language that is was developed by Sun that is still out there, that is still, in fact, being improved. And indeed, Java 2.0 is about to be released. Netscape never did a particularly good job of actually implementing Java. And in fact, at one point, they were thinking about writing a browser based in Java and basically gave up. The problem with Java has always been that write once, run anywhere has certain trade-offs because there, basically what you have to do is find kind of a common denominator across all operating systems currently, and there are things like there are no printer drivers in Java, so you have to write that separately, the way Java class libraries are currently constructed. But the bottom line on Java is that the way Java works is you've got to put what is called Java Virtual Machine on an operating system. And once you have that piece of software on any operating system, which is like an application, it can run any Java program. The fact is that the last time Java Virtual Machines were evaluated by PC Week magazine, guess whose Java Virtual Machine tended to do the best job of running pure Java programs. It happened to be Microsoft's. And guess how you get that Java Virtual Machine? You get it every time you buy a copy of Windows 98 or somehow acquire it. And it's not, doesn't have anything to do with IE. And there, most people, when they distribute programs written in Java, in fact, in almost every case that I'm aware of, typically distribute with their program a virtual machine so it'll run on an operating system. So in effect, while there is some evidence that that Microsoft in 1995-96 viewed Netscape as a potential alternative platform, because if you go back to that time, Netscape was talking about, in effect, commoditizing the operating system by basically converting the browser into a shell that essentially went over all operating machines. It had nothing to do with Java. Java is a different issue. It's a platform. Essentially, what Microsoft is being accused of doing is, although it implements pure Java very well with its virtual machine, because of some of the difficulties with Java, Microsoft also created a mechanism that a programmer using the Java language can write part of his or her program in Java, but then for certain aspects can make direct calls on the Windows operating system, can go directly to the APIs in the Windows operating system and do things that you can't do with pure Java. Basically, Microsoft created an option. Pure Java will run on Microsoft virtual machines. These other programs that make direct calls to Windows will also run. And the dispute is with Sun is whether or not Microsoft supports something called JNI, which is Sun's version of how you make direct calls on specific operating systems, not across all operating systems. So the real question is, which can Microsoft provide for software developers who want to write programs that call on the Windows operating system? Does Microsoft have to do what Sun says, or can Microsoft provide an alternative for developers that developers happen to want to use when they don't want to write once, run anywhere? Now, in my view, maybe I'm wrong, I always thought providing an additional alternative in the marketplace generally was a pretty good thing. And you can have a debate about Java, but it really is a debate that is distinct from the browser. The government, to some extent, has tried to mix the two issues up, but Java is a separate platform. It may be a competitive platform. It's one that Microsoft worries about and still worries about a lot, but it was a different platform that Netscape was promoting back in the 96 time frame that essentially the documents deal with, not Java.
We have one question from the audience, and I think because of the time, we should then adjourn for lunch, and then we'll have time at the end of the day for a substantial additional discussion period. I'm going to speak into the microphone. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bill Swigert from Swigert and Agin in Boston. And just as an aside, I played golf with a couple of engineers in Seattle who were employees of Microsoft Corporation this summer. And they had just, they were plowed out of their minds, actually. They'd just come from a party celebrating that day they had released the Java Software Developers Kit. And they agreed to play golf with me only on the condition that none of my clients had any connection with Sun Microsystems. So, one of the remedies that I've read about recently that might be the best outcome would simply be a finding that Microsoft Corporation is a monopoly. I know they spent an awful lot of time and effort in the first few months of the trial simply trying to defend against that charge, which seemed to me quite ludicrous. And they obviously are a monopoly. I wonder if any of the panelists would be interested in commenting on the fact that going forward, if there is a finding of monopoly, and I don't see how assuming it's not settled, I don't see how they could avoid that. If that in and of itself might constitute a remedy in that it will enable their competitors who will hopefully be facing them in court in the future in private actions, would give them a lot more leverage in being able to have a presumption in their favor since they're dealing with a monopolist.
Recognizing that having monopoly power and exercising it unlawfully are, of course, two different things. I don't know if we can do this in a few minutes. There's a lot to that question, and if someone wants to take a crack at it, I'd be most appreciative. Bob Levy?
I just want to take 10 seconds, and that is I do not presume that Microsoft has a monopoly, and this afternoon, if you folks will hang around, I'll give you a lot of good reasons to believe that they do not have a monopoly.
It's a tying arrangement. Stick around.
I'll just add
though. It'll antitrust humor.
Just
Professor Page.
I think while there are strong economic arguments that Microsoft's market share does not necessarily confer monopoly power in the same way that it would for other firms with similarly high market shares, I think it was probably a strategic mistake for Microsoft to try to contend that they lack monopoly power under prevailing legal standards, because it was the beginning of a pattern that's occurred throughout the trial in which contentions related to its positions were made to appear ridiculous to the court. And regardless of how peripheral they might be to the particular issue, it tended to create the impression, at least in the public mind, if not the courts, that Microsoft's witnesses were not credible, and that applied to both their expert witnesses and to their fact witnesses. So, I agree, it's not clear, even if you agree with the economic arguments that Microsoft's monopoly could disappear, in fairly short order, that it was necessarily the best strategic tact to fight to the death in that particular ditch.
Okay. One more comment by Professor Kovacic, and I think we will adjourn.
The finding of monopoly power could be used by other litigants and would enable them to start their cases with an assumption, assuming they're challenging the same basic market position, would allow them to focus on conduct concerns rather than monopoly power. That's an advantage for the private litigants.
The offensive use of collateral estoppel
that's
for
right.
Those in the legal business.
I'd add quickly, though, that the disposition of the conduct issues becomes terribly important as well, because if we assume that this goes to the distance, and God help us if there's a settlement, if it does go the distance, there will be significant treatments of each and every one of the significant conduct issues, and those conduct issues, the disposition of those issues would probably be a major hurdle for the same litigants. But if I'm thinking of bringing a private suit
and I see a favorable outcome on that issue. That's a plus for me as a private plaintiff.
Can I just mention one point real quickly?
Yeah, I know, because Rick in particular will not be able to be here this afternoon to defend himself.
Well, I may be here for a while, but I am going to have I will have to leave. The one point that I would make is that this case raises an interesting issue that I think is kicking around in the courts in a variety of different cases, and that is how in markets like this that where you see intellectual property as being an essential element, does one distinguish between rents that are generated by that property and monopoly? And quite apart from this case, you take, for example, a case like Toys R Us, where the intellectual property really is different, but it's a trade name and consumer goodwill that has been generated by the company. The FTC, and I think certain trends, are beginning to obliterate the importance of monopoly power and create the opportunity for attacking an increasing range of unilateral conduct by confusing what are rents to intellectual property with monopoly power and essentially being able to skip over the monopoly power issue and go directly to conduct. And that's why, and maybe it was a mistake to focus on traditional analysis, but I do think that this case, the Intel case, although it was settled, and other cases raise a very interesting question about how do we deal, how do we distinguish intellectual property from monopoly. And if we're not going to distinguish it, then it means almost every company, like a pharmaceutical company, like a software company, like any company that provides consumer goods, may essentially have to view itself as a monopolist for Section 2 purposes, and I don't think that's what the law was intended to do.
Well, I thank everybody this morning and early this afternoon for stimulating discussion. We will adjourn. For those of you who pre-registered, there are tables in the back for you for lunch, I've been instructed to say. Is that correct? Okay. And the rest of you have to fend for yourself. Which isn't quite accurate. But we will come back in just about an hour or so. Thank you. I do want to introduce Professor William Page. Oh, I was supposed to say go. I'm sorry. Okay. I would like now to introduce Professor William Page, the J. Will Young Professor of Law at the Mississippi College of Law. No, the Mississippi College School of Law. Thank you.
While Mercor was talking this morning about different scenarios for the future in the Microsoft case, I was reminded of Rick Barry's column about the movie Independence Day that came out a few years ago and described Earth being invaded by aliens. And Jeff Goldblum in that movie goes to the rescue of the Earth by flying one of the alien smaller spaceships up to the mothership and uploading a computer virus into the mothership's computer system and thereby causing them to drop their shields, and so the forces protecting Earth could shoot down their various craft. And Rick Barry's comment was that this was only possible because the mothership used the Microsoft Windows operating system, and in fact the reason they were invading was to try to defeat Microsoft and prevent it from taking over the universe. And so Jeff Goldblum was actually successful in making the universe safe for Bill Gates.
Yeah, I was rooting for the wrong side.
Today I want to zero in on one issue that Rick Rule brought up earlier, and that is the issue of integration. And I'm going to state things a little more bluntly than I did in my written text, perhaps in the hopes of provoking a little more comment. I want to make this in really four points. First, I want to talk about why the issue of integration of the browser and the Windows operating system is central or has been central to the litigation up to this point. Second, I want to explore the ways in which the opposing sides have litigated the issue of integration during the trial. You know, how Microsoft has attempted to show that the browser is integrated with Windows and how the government has attacked that. And then I want to ask, you know, does that amount to integration as a matter of law under the various standards that have been proposed, two in particular announced by the D.C. Circuit in the consent decree case, the majority opinion and Judge Wald's separate opinion. And then in the last part of my remarks, I want to explain why this whole inquiry is really a red herring from the point of view of, although it's interesting, it's really a red herring from the point of view of the legitimate concerns of antitrust policy. The issue of integration was, explicitly central to the consent decree case because that case enforced a provision of the 1995 consent decree that prohibited Microsoft from tying products to Windows, but a proviso allowed them to develop integrated products. Consequently, the whole question in the consent decree case was whether the inclusion of Internet Explorer in Windows 95 and the contractual provisions requiring the OEMs not to delete it constituted tying or whether they fell within the proviso. The D.C. Circuit in last June's opinion resolved this issue in a way that Microsoft could only have been elated by saying that the question of whether the browser is integrated would be resolved by simply requiring Microsoft to make a facially plausible showing that there are benefits associated with including the browser, integrating the browser, and that these benefits can only be achieved by bringing the browser and the operating system together at the manufacturing stage rather than having the user or the OEM accomplish that function. And in applying that, they concluded that at least for the purposes of reversing the preliminary injunction, that Microsoft had integrated the browser with Windows 95. Judge Wald viewed this as just a supine response to the problem of complexity and would have authorized a much more intrusive kind of examination of the relationship between the browser and the operating system, and in fact created a kind of sliding scale. If it's shown, to the degree that it's shown that the browsers constitute a separate market, as evidenced by being sold in separate channels, having separate competing manufacturers of browsers and so forth, the degree to which that was shown would indicate the degree to which Microsoft would have to prove that there are actual benefits from integration. And she made a few other comments that would have, made it much more difficult for Microsoft to establish that the browser was in fact integrated. At the time, the D.C. Circuit, and one other tidbit in the majority opinion, the D.C. Circuit made it very clear that they thought that this test was not only an interpretation of the consent decree, but that it would guide the application of the Sherman Act as well, and that it was fully consistent with tying law. Consequently, meanwhile, the government had brought its General Sherman Act case alleging that the combination of the browser with the Windows 98 operating system constituted a violation of Section 1 and Section 2 of the Sherman Act. It was a dark day for the government when they read this opinion. And in fact, shortly after that, over the course of the summer, the case was broadened somewhat to add allegations of, various bullying acts by Microsoft in certain negotiations with Internet partners and other software developers. Nevertheless, they have vigorously pursued the integration issue. They have contested the issue of integration at the trial, and Microsoft has responded to it. And what I want to do is explore exactly how that evidence has come out of trial. I want to start with Microsoft's assertion that the browser is integrated with the operating system. Microsoft essentially says that the browser became integrated with the operating system with version 3.0, because at that point, Internet Explorer in versions 1 and 2 were fairly simple one-file programs that even Jim Alton, their vice president, conceded constituted essentially applications. But with version 3.0, they componentized the technologies, the internet technologies associated with the browser, and essentially opening it up into different groups called dynamic linked libraries, which contain different types of internet technologies. For example, the MSHTML library contained the code that allows the browser to read and display HTML documents, which are that's the language that web pages are written in. And Microsoft contends that with version 3.0, they provided these DLLs and then opened up APIs or programming interfaces to them that allowed third-party software developers then to take advantage of the code and to make their applications more internet aware. Then with version 4.0, the integration went further, and the interface that Windows uses began to take advantage of the same APIs with these libraries. So, for example, the same code in these APIs would draw the windows on the screen and would allow the user to look at various sources of information other than the internet through the same windows, or to view the internet in an embedded window within the same window. And also, the interface adopted certain web-inspired devices like back and forward buttons and favorites lists and shortcuts and so forth, drag and drop shortcuts that could be put on the desktop, and so on. So essentially, the idea is that there are these shared files that can be used both by the non-Windows functionality of the operating system and by third parties. And with respect to third parties, they made a demonstration that, for example, Intuit's program Quicken uses the browsing functionality of Internet Explorer to allow, if you're in Quicken and you want to look at your stocks, if you have your portfolio entered into the Quicken program, you can click a button and it will go out to the internet to a web page maintained by Intuit, automatically update all the stock prices in your portfolio, and then cut off the connection. And this all happens within the same window as the Quicken program, whereas before you were required to open the browser, go to the web page, manually take that information, and then put it into the Quicken program to update your portfolio. So this is a benefit of integration, according to Microsoft. Now, Microsoft attempted to show this in a way that I think was clearly inspired by the D.C. Circuit's opinion, showing the benefits of integration. So they had a videotaped demonstration of the specifics of all of these benefits, 19 of them. The DOJ has opposed this demonstration in three main ways. First of all, the sort of what I would call the argument from principles of software design. Professor Farber of University of Pennsylvania testified that he began his direct testimony with certain definitions. He defined an operating system as consisting of the kernel, and he defined an application as consisting of stuff that runs on the kernel, and therefore a browser is an application, which had certain question-begging quality to it. But his broader argument was that in modern software design, everything is malleable, and everything can be put in modules that can be reused in various forms, and that there is absolutely no reason to put everything into these dynamic linked libraries that can't be deleted, to weld these into the operating system and then require them to be loaded into memory, as a whole. That there's no reason why that had to be done that way. Okay, so and he said this without actually studying the Windows source code. He said this is based on fundamental principles of software design. The second line of argument is what I would call the separate disks argument. For each of the benefits of integration in Windows 98 demonstrated in the Microsoft video, Boies played that benefit and then asked Jim Alchin, who is the Microsoft Vice President who supervised the creation of that video. Can you get that same benefit if you take a version of Windows 95 without Internet Explorer on it, the original retail version of it, and just install Internet Explorer version 4.0? And in each case, he said yes. And so the inference that the government sought to create by this, presumably, is that that proves that Internet Explorer is an application. You're installing it on top of, or it could be, an application that you install on top of the operating system. In each case, of course, Alchin objected and said, no, that's not what's happening when you install Internet Explorer version 4 on Windows 95. What happens is not simply the installation of a browser. You're going in and you're replacing core operating system files, you're changing the interface, you're rewriting code in various ways. Consequently, you're accomplishing an upgrade of the operating system. That's the answer to that. The third way in which the government has attacked the claim of integration is through the removal program that Edward Felton, a computer scientist at Princeton, developed a program that had as its goal and claimed effect of deleting Internet Explorer version 4 from Windows 98. And it did this, and you have to sort through a lot of sort of back and forth in the cross-examination of Felton because he objected to certain characterizations of what was done. But essentially what happened is that the program deletes the icon for Internet Explorer, deletes other ways in which the program can be triggered, rewrites some code, or rewrites the Windows registry in such a way that the program doesn't invoke Internet Explorer in certain ways so that you get a lot of error messages. And there are also some instances in which even if you install another browser on Windows 98, that it'll still go as the default browser, it'll still go to Internet Explorer for that function. And, for example, the Windows Update, where you want to download files directly from Microsoft to update the operating system, they've written that in such a way that you can only use Internet Explorer to do that. Felton left that in. But in all other instances in which Windows is so-called hard-coded to go to Internet Explorer, he changed that. Okay. But all of the dynamic linked libraries that Microsoft says contain the code that constitutes the Internet technologies underlying the browsing function, all those are there. You know, there's less than 1% of the code is altered or deleted. And, of course, Microsoft's challenge to this is that what's been done has not been to delete the browser. What's been done is simply to hide the browser. The browser constitutes the code. All you've done is to block that functionality. In addition, and this is where Microsoft really got into trouble with their videotape demonstration of this particular point, they wanted to show that the program degraded the operating system and made it less functional. And they had a videotape demonstration of this. And there were certain anomalies in the way it was presented. You know, the number of icons on the screen changed, and the title bar changed, and it made it look like they were showing different computers. So it looked like they were doctoring everything. So in a panic, Alchin hired a videotape crew. Overnight, they made another videotape that showed some of the decline in quality supposedly created by the program. And I want to back up and say one other thing. I forgot to mention the way in which they challenged the statement by Professor Farber that the operating system consists of low-level kernel functionality. Microsoft has always made the argument, continues to make the argument, that the operating system is basically what people want, the functionality that people want at any given time. You know, back in the old days, there was something called MS-DOS, and it had this really difficult-to-use text-based interface. And we've, you know, added to that by putting on a shell called Windows, and now that's integrated, and we've added all sorts of other functionality, and the browser is just the next step. So this is what the operating system is. It's whatever most people need for the sorts of information sources that they're going to be accessing, and now the web is one of those. Okay, so What's the bottom line? Are they integrated in a legal sense? Well, obviously it depends on what your test is. And under the D.C. Circuit's majority standard, I don't even think the government has tried to meet that standard. Each element of the government's challenge to Microsoft's claim was specifically refuted and rejected by the D.C. Circuit majority. So my only surmise is that the government is hoping that in the future that some other standard will be applied, because the argument from software design, the D.C. Circuit specifically said, we're not getting into that. If there's credible technical testimony that this was a beneficial way to go in the design, we're not going to try to pick between them. Second, with respect to the separate disks argument, this really was specifically dealt with. They said that installation of Internet Explorer on Windows 95 constituted an operating system upgrade, period. They said that. And finally, the business with the removal program looks a lot like using the add remove utility in Windows 95, which you can't use in Windows 98 because it doesn't exist, but it basically does the same thing. And what the D.C. Circuit majority said about that was that what that is simply hiding the key to the browser, not deleting the browser. Okay? So basically, if you apply the D.C. Circuit's test, there's absolutely no question the browser is integrated. Now, if you apply Judge Wald's test, as with most balancing tests, the outcome is indeterminate. The key change, of course, is that instead of asking for a plausible evidence that there are benefits, she requires you to actually prove that there are benefits. And the degree of the showing, the convincing, how convincing that showing has to be, is based on how much evidence there is of a separate market. Because the existence of a separate market, according to Judge Wall, is evidence that it's efficient to provide the browser separately from the operating system. And the evidence you said to look at for that, you know, just the existence of other browser providers, for example, I think a court could conclude that there is a separate market out there, or at least there are ways in which browsers are provided other than in operating systems. Consequently, Microsoft might be held to a very high standard. And to make matters worse for Microsoft, she specifically said toward the end of her opinion that this goal of removing, that she was willing to define the browser, or at least was receptive to the argument that the browser consisted solely of the ability to use the Internet, regardless of the code, that so that, you know, if you just switched off the browser, if say you have a house with hot and cold running water, if you took off all the faucets, then the house no longer has hot and cold running water. Whereas it seemed to me the majority opinion rejected that it's the plumbing, too, that constitutes hot and cold running water. But she was receptive to that argument. So basically, if Judge Wald's test gets applied, I think it could be found that the browser is not integrated. Now, here's why I think all of this is a big waste of time. This inquiry is very interesting, but to me it's pointless, because the whole idea of prohibiting tying under the theory that Judge Wald was using, and really the majority in some ways looked to the same test, was the idea that customers are forced to buy something they don't want or would prefer to acquire from another source. So, for example, in the Jefferson Parish against Hyde case, it was found to be anesthesia and surgery were found to be separate products, even though they were allegedly integrated in the way they were, you know, there were asserted benefits from the hospital having a specified anesthesia group providing anesthesia in all cases. And the consumer then was forced to use this anesthesiologist. Now, to me, this is not what's happening. Anytime you're in antitrust law, when you apply a per se rule, you don't just apply it. You've got to go back to the whole point of antitrust law. You know, does it make sense to say that this constitutes per se tying, or should we say that it's a different animal? And in this case, I think it is different, because what's going on is the browser, first of all, is free in all channels of distribution. And the government, as was pointed out earlier, has made absolutely no effort to prove that this constitutes predatory pricing. So everyone who offers browsers, essentially, not everyone, but most firms that offer browsers offer them free. Second, the use of a browser does not physically exclude the use of other browsers. So the inclusion of Internet Explorer on Windows 98 does not prevent you from using another browser. Now, there's evidence that there, you know, that Internet Explorer keeps popping up and so forth. A lot of that is anecdotal. I'm not sure it doesn't accord with my experience, essentially, that you can use both browsers. And the government says that, concedes in another part of their argument, that browsers, in fact, are not used in fixed proportions with the operating system. And I think that's true. People use two or even three browsers, sometimes simultaneously. Consequently, if you put these two things together, no physical exclusion, free, there's no forcing. So that's on one side. On the other side, it's a benefit to consumers. There's just no two ways about it. The consumer gets a state-of-the-art browser with the operating system, and added to that, it has an internet connection device that can be clicked on to, you know, bring you to an internet service provider in your area. So at least for consumers, maybe not for big organizations, but for consumers, there's no doubt that there's a benefit to that. Not for all consumers, but for a lot. So if there is a choice of Internet Explorer under these circumstances rather than Netscape, it's A, because consumers prefer it, in which case, what's the problem? Or B, because of inertia, that consumers, and there's a lot of sort of an assumption in the government's case that consumers are basically, you know, don't make discerning choices in this area. They basically take what's ever given to them. And Internet Explorer is, you know, handed to them on a platter, and so they don't even consider anything else. Now, it's possible, I suppose, to make the argument that inertia can be a mechanism for illegal exclusion. And I think that the idea of inertia is what's behind the government's idea of a level playing field or competition on the merits. What they're saying there is that Netscape and Microsoft should be required to compete head-to-head and not where Microsoft has a competitive advantage or an informational advantage. But, you know, my answer to that is, well, it's an informational advantage, but it's there. That advantage is the result of a cost saving to consumers. That consumers, by virtue of getting the browser with the operating system, get something that saves them the cost of acquiring it by some other mechanism. So that sort of competitive advantage, just by itself, is a net consumer benefit. So my question is, forget about the benefits of integration. Why isn't that enough? You know, Microsoft originally offered the argument that a browser was integrated, this is in the consent decree case, browser was integrated if it's included in the same box with the operating system and it's not sold separately in the OEM channel. And the government characterized that as the argument that, well, we can integrate a ham sandwich with the operating system if we wanted to. Well, in my opinion, in this case, I think the ham sandwich test has something to be said for it, because the benefits of integration, it seems to me, don't change the basic fact that there's a consumer benefit here and no serious forcing going on of consumers. Now, we can speculate about future scenarios, perhaps Netscape later evolving into a platform that will eventually threaten Microsoft, but Microsoft's operating system monopoly. But I tend to think that where there's a clear present consumer benefit, we don't give it up unless there's some real present anti-competitive effect, and I don't see it on these facts. And I'll leave it at that.
Our next speaker is Bob Levy, a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute.
Some of you may have seen from the bio that I just recently got out of law school.
So I know what a lot of you are going through. In fact, Bill Kovacic, who had to leave early, was my contracts professor in law school. Some people ask, what's it like to go back to law school when you're in your 50s? And I was warned, of course, that there would be a lot of work, which indeed it was. The professors actually warned me that my wife, Diane, and I would experience what the law professors call loss of consortium. But I'm proud to announce that exactly the reverse occurred. It turns out that Diane and I were gripped by an urgent passion at the mere mention of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The thinly veiled eroticism of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. Now, let me start with first principles. I think they're straightforward and conclusively, in my mind, resolve this dispute. Department of Justice and 19 state attorneys general intend to transform Microsoft's private property into something that belongs to the public, to be designed by bureaucrats and sold on terms that are congenial to Microsoft's rivals, companies that are intent on putting Microsoft out of business or at least at a competitive disadvantage. So the principles involved are these. No one other than Microsoft has a right to the operating system that it created. Consumers can't demand that it be provided at any particular price or with any particular features, and competitors are not entitled to share in its advantages. So when the government demands that the Windows desktop be exploited for the benefit of competitors, or even indeed for the benefit of consumers, I think our politicians, a few misguided businessmen who happen to be losing in the marketplace, and not a few academics are helping those who debase private property and doing an enormous disservice to those of us who have a healthy respect for free markets and a free society. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's it. That's the end of the story, and everything else I'm going to tell you is filler. Now, I will say that that, unhappily, from my perspective, is not the battleground on which this antitrust war is being fought. So instead of property rights, which is the issue that I've just outlined for you, the Microsoft case centers on the economic efficiency and consumer welfare. So reluctantly, I'm going to address those issues, particularly three issues. First, does Microsoft have a monopoly? Second, if it has a monopoly, has it exercised its monopoly in a manner that somehow forces consumers to buy a product they don't want or would rather have acquired in some different fashion? And third, if Microsoft has a monopoly and if Microsoft has behaved badly, will government intervention improve matters? That is, you know, should we prefer political power under Bill Clinton to market power under Bill Gates? And the answer to all three of those questions has to be yes in order to justify a government role. If the answer to any of those questions is no, then the antitrust division should step aside. And I'm going to argue that Microsoft has no monopoly in the context in which that term ought to be understood under the antitrust laws. Secondly, that consumers haven't been harmed, they've been helped by Microsoft's aggressive behavior. And third, even if a problem existed, the Justice Department doesn't have the foggiest idea what to do about it. So let me begin with the question of whether or not Microsoft has a monopoly. Economists define monopoly power as the ability to exact greater profits by raising price or by somehow excluding competition. But the price of Windows on a comparable features basis is plummeted. When Windows came out in April of 1990 and DOS was sold as an extra product, the price was $205. Here we are 9 years later, and the full price is not $205 but $169, and you can get updates for $85. And if you look at Mac OS, if you don't think it's simply the decline in Windows, but a comparison of Windows to other operating systems, instead of $85 for an update, Mac OS is $99, and OS 2 is something like $275. But more importantly, the features that are now a standard part of Windows, like modem support and fax utilities and CD-ROM drivers and the like, they originally were sold as separate products, and each of them cost more than all of Windows costs today. And the National Economic Research Associates has estimated that Windows 98 users are going to be paying less than one-fifth of what they paid 10 years ago for software, which at that time had fewer features than the software today. So prices are declining, and not only are they declining, but they're already low in absolute terms. The price of an operating system is less than 3% of the price of a PC. Now, I think it's fair to conclude, therefore, that if price gouging is the mark of a monopolist, that Microsoft simply doesn't qualify. Now, what about Microsoft's purported 85 to 90% share of
PC operating systems, call it 87.5%. Doesn't that by itself signify monopoly power? The answer is unequivocally, it does not. The corollary of an 87.5% market share is that 12.5% of the people are using something else. Now, 12.5% is not a huge number, but it's not a trivial number. One customer in eight does not use Microsoft. They use Mac OS or Unix or OS 2 or BOS, to name a few. I checked the Linux website. It's available on an Intel platform from 40 dealers in the United States with an estimated 10 million users. Apple, with 13 million users, reports sharply rising iMac sales, and nearly half of those new sales are either new users or Microsoft converts. So in terms of existing competition, there are alternatives. And it's not only existing competition, but potential competition that matters. Network computing technology with software downloaded from the Internet could convert the PC from a processor into an inexpensive communications device. Digital TVs, other consumer electronics devices could radically diminish the importance, the scope, the nature of the operating system. And in November of 1998, the Netscape AOL deal all by itself changed the competitive landscape overnight. Netscape and AOL announced, as you know, which at that time was valued at a $4.2 billion, acquisition of poor, beleaguered Netscape, as well as a close working relationship with Sun Microsystems. Even Judge Jackson acknowledged that this deal could have a major impact on the Microsoft case. For starters, any court-ordered remedy today could well be out of date tomorrow. The merger suggests that e-commerce, not browsers, not operating systems, but e-commerce is where the greatest profit opportunities lie. This is a $26 billion business just 2 years ago in 1996. It's expected to grow to a $1 trillion business by the year 2005. And Internet commercial traffic is going to be driven primarily by portals or home pages, only secondarily by browsers and operating systems. And when it comes to portals, AOL and Netscape is far out in front. They're even ahead of Yahoo, and Microsoft's network is a distant 10th in terms of portals. Now, not only is Microsoft lagging in e-commerce, but its new Windows 98 operating system is threatened by a company that controls nearly 90% of the PC operating system market, and that is Microsoft itself. Even if Microsoft were to go out of business this afternoon, all of its installed systems would continue to function indefinitely. So if Microsoft wants to sell me a new product like Windows 98, it's going to have to convince me to put up money to go through a learning curve to master that product and to run the risk that the software I have for my existing product is going to be incompatible. That imposes a very powerful discipline on Microsoft's behavior. It's utterly inconceivable that Microsoft is going to alienate the very customers that it has to rely on for all of its new sales. Windows 98, it's true, is being sold with a million new PCs each month, but that's trivial compared to the 300 million existing Microsoft customers. So the major competition for Windows 98 is Windows 95, just like the major competition for Windows 95 was Windows 3.1. So the relevant market share is not 87.5% that Microsoft has, but break the products down, 33% that Windows 95 has, 32%. Still held by Windows 3.0 various versions. Ask yourself, if Microsoft has such power, how come it could only coerce a third of its users to upgrade to its flagship product when it came out with Windows 95? Now, that said, let's assume for argument's sake that Microsoft has a monopoly. By itself, as you've heard this morning, monopolies are not illegal under the antitrust laws. Now, the government's supposed to step in only if the alleged monopolist is misusing its power. So just what is it that Microsoft is doing that's raising hackles at DOJ? DOJ's own witness, MIT professor Franklin Fisher, was asked whether consumers have been harmed by Microsoft. His response was, quote, on balance, I think that the answer is no, close quote. But according to the Justice Department, Microsoft has barred Netscape from access to Windows customers by negotiating exclusionary contracts. Now, I think that claim on its face is preposterous. There are 120 million copies of Netscape's browsers delivered in 1998 alone. Over 65 million Internet users start up at NetCenter, which is the second most visited site on the web, next to Yahoo, with Microsoft running a distant third. Over 400,000 websites linked to Netscape's homepage. That's more than twice the number that linked to Microsoft's homepage. Netscape is in control of 42% of the browser market and will soon control an additional 16% through its new partner, America Online. That adds up to 58%. And, of course, AOL, as I mentioned to you, paid more than $4 billion, actually much more than that when you take into account the price change in the stock since the date that the merger was announced, to acquire a four-year-old company to build a $4 billion value, a company purportedly mangled by the tactics of Microsoft. Well, how is it, according to the Justice Department, that Microsoft succeeded in excluding Netscape from this market? Well, first, says the government, Microsoft told PC manufacturers, OEMs, that they had to take Internet Explorer. They couldn't have Windows. This is known, as you've heard, as a tying arrangement. Now, that assertion is correct, as a matter of fact, but it's not germane to DOJ's charge that these are exclusionary contracts. Plain and simple, Microsoft's tying contracts with OEMs are not exclusionary. To require that they take Internet Explorer is not to exclude Netscape. Any customer who doesn't want to use Microsoft's free browser is perfectly welcome to use Netscape's free browser because Microsoft imposes no restrictions on Netscape's use. When Judge Jackson conducted his famous experiment and he called a courtroom employee in to uninstall Netscape, he found out he could do it in He found out that he could do it in less than 90 seconds. Of course, he asked the question, why shouldn't Microsoft, if it only takes 90 seconds, it's such a simple matter, why shouldn't we require Microsoft to take care of this for us? The question he should have asked is, why in the world do we need to commandeer the resources of the federal government to solve a problem that any consumer can solve in a minute and a half? Now, tying can be, of course, exclusionary. It can be exclusionary in two instances. First, a technological tie that actually disables another browser from working, or a contractual tie that forecloses another browser by agreement. But Microsoft uses neither of those. It uses bundling, which is non-exclusive. Microsoft simply prevents OEMs by contract from deleting Internet Explorer. It does not prevent OEMs from using Netscape or any other browser. When Netscape, by the way, had superior browser technology, it did seek to exclude Internet Explorer by offering payments to OEMs. By the way, you may recall that Microsoft also tied the Microsoft network to Windows 95 in an attempt to dislodge AOL as the leading online provider. Result, Microsoft network loses $200 million a year, serving about 2 million customers. AOL is making a ton of money, serving about 14 million customers. So despite all of the whining, Microsoft's clout turned out to be, in that case, impotent. Consumers didn't like the Microsoft network, and they couldn't be forced to buy it. And the same thing was true of Internet Explorer versions 1 and 2, which were tied to Windows, but did not take business away from Netscape, because consumers did not like those versions. And Money, which made almost no headway against Quicken in the personal finance arena. So that Microsoft's tie-ins certainly do not guarantee success. It is fair to say that any system, however, that doesn't include these integrated functions is an incomplete system, and that's why IBM and Sun, like Microsoft, packages browsers with its operating system. It's also why Netscape ties a wide variety of software products to its browser, including security systems and graphics. And when Netscape had a virtual monopoly in browsers, it tied email to its browser, virtually destroying Eudora as an email provider. But Netscape's product designs, just like Microsoft's product designs, are better left to computer companies than to government lawyers. Now, Department of Justice also points not only to the OEM contracts as exclusionary, but to Microsoft's contracts with service providers and content providers supposedly entered into with the intent, the design of burying Netscape. Well, companies, as you know, negotiate exclusive deals all the time. Those exclusive deals can run afoul of the antitrust laws when one of the companies is a monopolist and is exploiting that monopoly power. So the question we have to ask is whether Microsoft has tried to leverage its alleged operating system monopoly to obstruct these service providers and content providers from doing business with Netscape. You've heard, for example, that the gripes coming from the Justice Department that Microsoft offered a place on its Windows desktop to Intuit and to America Online and to some other service providers and content providers, but only if those companies would either reduce or sever their dealings with Netscape. Now, true or not, and Microsoft vigorously disputes the allegations, those contracts, even if they did occur, are utterly irrelevant to this case. Because whatever Microsoft may enjoy in the way of monopoly in operating systems, it did not exploit that particular monopoly in negotiating those so-called exclusionary contracts. In a nutshell, the Justice Department has identified the wrong market. And let me tell you how the government missed the boat. Microsoft, you may remember, did not tell Intuit, and it did not tell AOL and the others that they couldn't buy the Windows operating system. Instead, Microsoft is charged with refusing to provide space on the Windows desktop, a very different thing. The desktop is the means by which those companies, AOL, Intuit, and the others, could advertise and even distribute their products. So the pertinent market in which to look for Microsoft's monopoly power isn't the operating systems market. They put no restrictions on the purchase of their operating system. It's the market for advertising and software distribution. Now consider the Lorraine Journal case. That's the one where Robert Bork, that he trots out in arguing episodically that the antitrust laws are good for us. In that case, you may recall, the Journal newspaper supposedly had a lock on advertising in Lorraine, Ohio. And when a radio station tried to compete for ad dollars, the Journal threatened to not to accept any advertising from any company that plugged its products on the radio. Now, that's clearly an exclusionary deal, and the Supreme Court ruled against the Journal, concluding that it did indeed have a monopoly, not in the provision of news, but in the provision of advertising. So to the extent that the Lorraine Journal had any leverage at all over its customers, it was in withdrawing ad space, not in denying them the right to buy the newspaper. And similarly, Microsoft limits ads by denying these companies a place on the Windows desktop. It does not deny these companies the opportunity to purchase Windows. But unlike the Lorraine Journal, Microsoft does not have a monopoly in advertising or, for that matter, software distribution. Vendors, as you well know, sell software through retail stores over the Internet, by mail order, bundled with hardware, a whole variety of other channels. Internet services is advertised in newspapers and magazines and radio and TV and direct mail and on and on and on. So not even the Windows desktop. Even if we want to restrict this advertising market or software distribution market to the Windows desktop, not even the Windows desktop is controlled by Microsoft. Microsoft only uses 7 of 49 available icons. 85% of the desktop is available to OEMs and to consumers who can display icons for any product that they wish, including software produced by Netscape or other Microsoft rivals. So in order to show that Microsoft uses its monopoly to coerce customers into signing exclusionary contracts, the government has to first examine the correct monopoly, and it hasn't done so. Let me expand on that argument in one respect. Justice argues that Microsoft uses its control over the desktop, over the opening screen, to dictate Internet content. On initial boot up, Windows 95 did have these active channels that guided users to favorite content providers like MSNBC. But Netscape, of course, had similar cross-promotional deals with companies like ABC News. Microsoft has discontinued those deals in Windows 98. But more important, users and OEMs can easily remove the channel bar, add active channels, install rival software, even make Netscape the default browser, and users can go a step further. Once they get the machine, they can substitute a shell for the first screen, in which case the Internet icon, Internet Explorer icon, will disappear forever. So ask yourself whether you'd be upset if a car dealer preset the radio stations on your new car. Obviously not, because you can easily change the presets anytime you want. Microsoft's rules are even less restrictive than those imposed by your favorite restaurant. Try bringing your own dessert to a dining establishment. The rule is you want to meet my restaurant, you're going to pick from the items off of my menu. Microsoft is a lot more user-friendly than that. It says, look, here are my preferences. I'm going to show you where I think you ought to go. I'm even going to help you get there to get to my preferred desserts. But if you absolutely insist on substituting your own desserts and bringing your desserts into my restaurant and eating your desserts in my restaurant, we're going to let you do so. And if content restriction is the issue here, imagine the limitless control over Internet content when the government begins dictating what icons are going to appear on Microsoft's opening screen. Now, finally, let me examine the third element of the test for government intervention. I'm going to assume, contrary to fact, that Microsoft has a sustainable monopoly. And I'm also going to assume, contrary to fact, they've exploited this monopoly power in a manner that harms consumers. And that still leaves this third question, does government have a better solution? Keep in mind now that we're talking about the same technologically impaired government that blew $4 billion on IRS computers and whose Y2K problems could bring down Western civilization as we know it. So before too eagerly substituting government solutions for market solutions, I think we should carefully consider the consequences. The Justice Department's hired gun, David Boies, and the antitrust chief, Joel Klein, has floated a number of structural remedies, the unintended consequences of which are guaranteed to harm consumers. These, I'm going to call them pathetic proposals, because that's what I believe they are, they punish vigorous competition by dismembering the winning competitor. So I want to outline very briefly, because I know other speakers are going to cover these subjects, the government's three favorite plans. I'm going to start from the moronic to the mere foolish. The first plan, the first option is vertical divestiture. Microsoft would be split into two or three parts. One company would keep the Windows operating system, the second company would get applications, programs like Access and Excel and Word and the like, and the third company would take on the internet and maybe e-commerce products. Now, evidently, whoever designed that solution has never read the Justice Department's initial complaint, which, after all, is about a company that purportedly has a monopoly in PC operating systems. And normally, one doesn't attack a monopoly by spinning off the monopoly company into a separate company. But what's worse, vertical divestiture is going to require ongoing government decisions about whether a product is part of the operating system or whether it's part of an application or whether it's internet related. And just look at the browser wars if you want to see how difficult it can be to compartmentalize a product within a nearly seamless operating environment. And look at the AT&T fiasco if you want to see how easy it is for a court to get bogged down in post-divestiture regulation. The second trial balloon calls for horizontal divestiture. So each of several vertically integrated clones, baby bills, would receive full rights to Microsoft's source code and other intellectual property. And they could then go out and they're free to compete fiercely and freely against one another. May the better bill win. At least, of course, until a new leader emerges, at which time the Department of Justice will undoubtedly call for another divestiture to buy some more time. And nobody seems to know which corporate bill is going to get the real-life bill or whether the new operating system's features that are developed have to be shared with all of the companies that are created, and if so, why any company would continue to innovate knowing that its competitor is going to reap all the benefits. The third structural remedy, which is really a variation on this horizontal divestiture, it has all of its problems and then some, is that basically Microsoft is going to be forced to license the Windows source code to several other companies, each of which could develop and then sell independently that source code, and that creates, so the argument goes, instant competition in the operating systems business. Now, the problem should be obvious. If new technology is going to be declared public property, new technology is simply not going to materialize. And if technology is going to be treated proprietary, as new it ought to be, then it must not be expropriated. And once expropriation becomes the remedy of choice, the goose is unlikely to continue laying golden eggs. Meanwhile, government-driven balkanization of the operating system's protocols is going to wipe out Microsoft's most important contribution to software markets, which has been standardization. So then, like the Unix system, Windows is going to end up with a dozen or more variations, no common platform on which software's developers can build, and the result will be fewer applications programs and higher costs of development and therefore higher user prices. Now, globally, we've had millions of programmers developing thousands of compatible programs thanks to the standardized platform that Windows affords. If the government gets its way, that enormous value will disappear overnight. Now, if you want to uncover what's really driving these browser wars, read DOJ's complaint and the accompanying legal memorandum. And there you'll find Netscape mentioned 130 times in 130 pages. Now, this is just government resources co-opted for the welfare of a competitor, not consumers. Instead of focusing on new and better products, we have software executives. We find them consorting with former members of Congress or their staffers, antitrust officials, former judges, the best lobbying and public relations firms that that money can buy. And Microsoft, believe me, is going to learn to play that game in a hurry, and it too will become very successful at currying favor with the politicians in Washington, D.C., that were worried about the 800-pound gorilla in the marketplace. Wait till the 800-pound gorilla begins to acquire political power. Now, one can only speculate about the motives underlying what I think is a destructive crusade by the Justice Department. But when the head of the antitrust division meets six times to discuss this case with a disaffected Microsoft competitor, including breakfast at the competitor's home, the conclusion, in my view, is all but inescapable that the antitrust laws are being used as an anti-competitive subsidy to prop up unsuccessful firms. Now, perhaps the motives are somewhat less insidious, just empire building, for example, that's become standard operating procedure in Washington, D.C. Clinton has asked for a 17% increase in funding for the antitrust division to pay for 943 employees. That's up 26% in 2 years. They're going to be working on 514 cases. That's up 35% in 2 years. This is in the era of diminished government, mind you. The Citizens Against Government Waste has estimated that Microsoft litigation has already slapped taxpayers with a bill of $30 to $60 million. Now, to justify those expenditures and those kinds of increases, the Department of Justice has to provide the American public with dramatic evidence of its effectiveness. Hence, we have this high-profile case with sensational remedies as the exit strategy, and it's played to the media. And it focused not on substantive legal issues, but on public ridicule of a company and its chief executive. We deserve better. The threat of abusive public power is far larger than the threat of private monopoly, especially when it comes to software, because unlike oil and utility and railroads and other capital-intensive ventures, software isn't based on physical equipment. It's based on ideas. It's based on human intellect, which the economist Julian Simon has called the ultimate resource. No company monopolizes ideas. The history of software is that better ideas mean better products, and better products win in the marketplace. If the Justice Department prevails in its attack against Microsoft, we will have politicized the competition, enlisting the public sector in pursuit of private parochial interests, and the result is likely to be no better than the 13-year campaign against IBM, which turned into nothing but a wealth transfer program from IBM shareholders and consumers to lawyers and expert witnesses. IBM's market power was indeed erased, but it wasn't by Justice Department lawyers. It was by guys like Bill Gates creating new products that the lawyers could never imagine to exist. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. You just have to learn to come out and say what you really think.